Hi, welcome back to the TT1 Explorer podcast. I'm Tanya Tomaszewska. For those who listened to my last episode, you'll know that it was all about my recent adventures in that crazy place called Las Vegas. I'll admit, I enjoy short and vibrant doses of frenetic urban life. But truth be told, the peace, quiet, and serenity of mountains and ocean is more reflective of my preferred state. I'm an island girl, and so today, I'm delighted to be taking you on a virtual flight back to my native Vancouver Island, at the southernmost part of British Columbia's wild Pacific coast. Specifically, we're going to Alderley Vineyards, a very small, family-run winery located in a truly lovely and idyllic pocket of farmland in the northern Cowichan Valley, about an hour drive north of the city of Victoria, where I grew up. My guest today is Julie Powell, co-owner and co-winemaker at Alderley Vineyards. As you'll hear, Alderley has some of the oldest vines in this coastal wine area, but the plantings in this business were new to Julie and her husband, Zach Brown, when Julie and Zach left their respective lengthy careers in human resources and health and safety and purchased Alderley in 2017. I first met Julie and Zach a few years after that, in 2019. At the time, I was really diving into exploring and understanding what was happening in what we informally call our Wine Islands, a region comprised of the Cowichan Valley, other parts of Vancouver Island, and a number of Southern Gulf Islands. I was conducting an advance trip to the area as I was planning to guide the Maple Leaf's inaugural Wine and Islands cruise expedition. For longtime listeners, you'll recall that I spoke with Maureen Gordon of Maple Leaf Adventures about their business and the Wine Islands region in episode 8 of this podcast series. At the time I went to Alderley, I had noticed that Alderley was hitting the island's farmers market circuit, and previously I had tried their Sauvignon Blanc at a restaurant in Vancouver, and I really had enjoyed it. So I was intrigued. I made an appointment and went to visit Alderley to see their land, to meet Julie and Zach. We spent a good amount of time in their small, cozy, and inviting tasting room, chatting and tasting through their wines. Of course, I've been back to Alderley since then, and I continue to enjoy their wine and introduce it to others. Looking back on things now, what struck me about Alderley and what really resonated with me during that very first visit was their intentionality. The intentionality about the land and the legacy of which Julie and Zach were now the custodians, intentionality about the types of wines which they wanted to craft and how to farm the land to do so, intentionality around how everyday tasters and visitors to their winery will experience their wines in their place. For me, all of this was consistent with and exemplifies how our coastal vintners are articulating their emerging and exciting and very small wine region to a very large global wine map. Remember, on average, this region typically produces less than 3% of British Columbia's wines. Rather than trying to emulate or evoke other world wine regions, which have very different climates, more heat, and different soils, winemakers and producers here in the Wine Islands are making wine which reflects their own terroir or place, and I'd even say miroir of the spectacular Salish Sea which surrounds them. And now, almost 5 years from my first meeting with Alderley, my own observations are that Julie and Zach's intentionality is also very apparent in how they are growing their business and where they wish their future to lie. There's power in dialing it in, knowing who you are, and being or staying small. I hope that you enjoy my discussion with Julie Powell today. Let's fly! Hi, Julie. Thanks so much for joining as my guest today.
Hi, Tanya. Lovely to be with you.
So I thought that today's episode could be about a few different things. Your story, the Alderley story, and how a small winery can really dial it in and get it right, not only in terms of winemaking, but also from a business planning perspective. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the Cowichan Valley and our Wine Islands region as a very distinct Pacific coastal wine region in terms of where Pacific coastal producers would like to go. But before we dive into these larger questions, I'd love to kick it off with how this wine adventure all started for you. You know, how did you get the bug? How is it that your life brought you to beautiful Cowichan Valley and become a winery owner after you'd lived and worked in so many other parts of the world?
Well, it's a great question. It's been quite a journey. Essentially, I guess it just boils down to a hobby run amok. I tell people I married a man with hobbies, and winemaking happens to be one of them. He learned to make wine about 30 years ago now. That's going to date us, but he was living in Europe in the Czech Republic, and then later he moved on when he was in his career, his old career, in Australia and had some exposure to some of the wines regions there and the styles of wines they're making, which obviously quite different from Europe. So shortly after we were married, we were posted in Montreal, and before long he had joined this amateur winemaking group of garagistes, as they're known, and next thing you know, a ton of grapes had shown up from California, and we were making wine in the garage, as you do.
Truly garagiste.
Yeah, absolutely. And that only continued when we moved 3 years later to Vancouver. We're sort of more from the coast. Zach's a Vancouver Islander by birth, pretty much. And so it was nice to get back to what we would consider our home, really. And we continued making wine in an East Vancouver driveway, and started to think that maybe one day, when we eventually got tired of these big jobs that we had, and we could kind of see that, you know, at some point we wanted to do something different. We had this dream that we could have our own vineyard and a dog named Vino, and that's kind of where it started.
Oh my gosh, I love it. So you manifested the vision and the destiny. And having lived in different parts of the world and worked for, I understand, very large companies, I think some in the resource space. So wine, you know, wine is about passion and story, and it's also about farming, and it's also about running a business. And you each had been part of very large businesses in different sectors. Now that you're in the winery space, you know, there is a massive amount of work that goes into each bottle of that wine that you create and you sell and you offer to your people. So looking in the rearview mirror for a moment, you know, what experiences or skills or learnings from your previous career or previous incarnation or work experience or pursuits, you know, what do you think you draw on now, or what do you think has helped you in this adventure, your winery business?
Well, as you can imagine, it certainly does take a diverse set of skills to do what we do, because there's so many different components. There's obviously the farming side of things, the winemaking side of things, and running a business. And at first, you know, you kind of wonder how much of what you've been doing all your life is really transferable. Obviously, the amateur winemaking skills, for sure, were integral to that. But it doesn't always seem intuitive. You know, HR and health and safety backgrounds. But what we did have was sort of extensive experience, you know, in those large kind of multinationals in fairly senior functional leadership roles. So we came into this with a pretty good understanding of business, you know, the importance of a clear strategy, how to manage a cash flow, you know, managing budgets, managing people. And we had a lot of skills that were immediately adaptable to what we were doing. For example, our flexibility and our ability to adapt to change, which was kind of constant in our former careers, our ability to problem solve, to plan, staying focused and, you know, really being clear about what it is we needed to do to be successful, and to borrow a phrase often used in my old career, to sort of focus in on what we call the critical few. So what were the key things we needed to get right in order to make a success of this, or at least not completely fall on our faces? So we really boiled it down to three things. Have a healthy vineyard, look after your vines, because without good grapes, you can't make anything. Make great wine. That's a lot easier to sell than bad wine. And keep your customers happy. You know, they're really the ones that are going to be, again, critical to our success. So those were sort of the three legs of the stool. And we really tried to, as I say, stay focused and stay away from a lot of the shiny distractions that are out there in this industry that can consume your time, your energy, and certainly your money, and not necessarily help you run your business.
There is so much in that that would be applicable, I feel, for any person starting a business or jumping into a business that might be in a different sector, which initially they feel is a wildly different paradigm. But all of those things which you've just elucidated, I think, down to, you know, your three-legged stool, so to speak, exemplifies the clarity that I think is evident in your business, and is reminiscent to me of some of the conversations I've had with some winemakers and winery owners in the Okanagan Valley, some of your colleagues who've said, you know, it's important about dialing it in and getting it right. And the getting it right thing is the focus, and figuring out what works best for you. So, you know, in a few moments, I wanted to jump ahead to some of your, pick up on some of the topics you mentioned there from a business perspective, but one of the things that you probably didn't have a lot of direct experiences is the farming, which is, as you mentioned in your very first point, the healthy vineyard, you know, farming, good, you can't have good wine without good farming. So for those who aren't familiar with Alderley, could you just share a little bit about your vineyards, you know, how much land you farm, what grape varieties you grow, if you have to source from anyone else, you know, where you are and why you think that's a good place for making the kind of wine that you'd like to make.
Sure. Well, we did take a little bit of time, obviously. It took us the better part of 10 years to find the right spot, for sure. We had looked at properties early on Vancouver Island, as well as the Okanagan. We even considered at one point when we were living overseas, purchasing something in France or, you know, other parts of the world, even further away, New Zealand and such. But we kind of kept coming back to Vancouver Island. So this was kind of the place we decided we needed to be. But as you well know, we're such a tiny wine region, you know, for BC even, that there aren't a lot of properties. But size was important, something that the two of us could do ourselves. So that really kind of helped us sort of keep that dialed in. So when we saw Alderley, a 10-acre property with 7.5 acres of vines producing about 2,000 cases a year, we thought, you know, that seems manageable. But inevitably, we knew that we would want to grow a little bit more in the way of fruit. So right now we have 7.5 acres here, which is a mix of vinifera and hybrid whites and reds. So notably on the white side, some of our oldest planting, 30-year-old Bacchus vines. We've got Pinot Gris, Sauvignon Blanc, a little bit of Viognier, a little bit of Gewurztraminer. On the red side, again, hybrid-wise, we've got very old Maréchal Foch vines, alongside the Cabernet Sauvignon hybrid daughters of Cabernet Foch and Cabernet Libre. Of course, Pinot Noir that grows quite well here. And then the sort of wild card Merlot that we wouldn't have planted if it wasn't already here when we took over, but as it's a bit of a nail biter every year as to whether or not it's going to get warm. But to that point, the location here couldn't be better. We're, you know, we've got this lovely south-facing orientation over Quamichin Lake. We're in a rain shadow. There's four mountain peaks that shelter us from the ocean about 3 kilometers away as the crow flies. So in fact, all of the vineyards on the north end of the Cowichan Valley benefit from that microclimate. And it does get quite hot here. I finally found the hottest place in Canada to live year round. We have the hottest mean temperature in the country. So that's great for growing grapes. Again, it was a very well-chosen spot, and really all credit before going any further to Roger and Nancy Dossman, who developed the spot in the early 90s and had the vision. So, you know, we had a really strong foundation. Really, Roger put in all the right things. He put in full drainage, which, you know, early on you really needed in this region. We do get a lot of precipitation, but he also put in irrigation, which I think people thought he was nuts. Like, what are you doing? We don't need that here, right? This isn't the Okanagan. Of course, now he looks like a savant having put that in, given the, you know, what we experience with climate change. So really we're kind of tried to focus on taking it to the next level, building on a really, really healthy foundation, introducing some more of our farming practices and, you know, things around sustainability that's really important to us and kind of linked to our core values, and bringing that to bear. And I think it's really paying off for us here.
Thanks for mentioning your sustainability practices. Sustainability is a very broad term, and people both in the wine industry and consumers or observers may have different ideas of what that means in the context of a business and also farming and making wine. Can you give a few examples of the types of sustainability practices or tools which you and Zach are employing, you know, whether it's in the viticulture or how you conduct your business? Just an example for people who haven't been to your land or who aren't familiar with this, you know, what this line of thinking.
Sure. So certainly starting in the vineyard is one of the examples that immediately springs to mind. So whilst we do have that irrigation installed and we do use it, we use it very sparingly. We use obviously drip irrigation, so it's very efficient. When we came on board, we installed some water sensors in the different areas of the vineyard so that we could monitor our water use. And so they essentially, without getting too technical, sit at 30 centimeters and 80 centimeters so that we can tell after the rain has come, or after we've been watering a bit, is the water actually getting to the root structure? And do we need to water less? Do we need to water a little bit more? So we don't want to be wasting water. Similarly, we're located in amongst a lot of farms here on Stamps Road. So we have neighbors with horses. They're all too happy to part with their stable waste. We collect it a few times a month. We build a giant pile. At harvest time, we add the grape skins, seeds, and stems from the pressing process. We turn that over several times, and then about 6 months later, that goes out into the vineyard and really replaces the much-needed sort of potassium and boron and sort of some other things. Well, actually, not boron. We get that from a granular organic fertilizer that we use in combination with the compost to really, again, give that nutrient back, solves a problem for a neighbor, and it just, again, helps contribute to the health of our vineyard.
So thank you for all of that detail down into the composition of some of the soils and what you need for the farming. For me, this ties into a couple of points broadly about people talking a lot about regenerative farming, not only in the wine industry point of view, but broader agri, and the need to have health in the soils so that we can have the healthy products come from the soils, not only for what we're putting in our bodies, but also the long-term sustainability of, you know, where we live and how we farm and how we move on this planet. And you know, taking the long-term view and all the investment now, particularly in times with the acute weather patterns and climate change and weather events. And some of our colleagues in the Okanagan Valley, I think, are chatting about going back to looking at how farming is done and if things need to be adjusted so that the roller coaster of Mother Nature during these acute challenges can be better weathered, so to speak. So I imagine at the stage you're at in a business of a winery, a lot of work and thought goes into this, and you may not see the immediate results, but it's really for the long-term, I guess, stewardship of the land.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. As you say, there was a really healthy foundation. We are one of the older vineyards here on the island. So, you know, we really wanted to make sure that the vineyard stayed healthy. And we did, you know, some testing early on of our soils, peat-eel samples, to really get an idea, are there some nutrient gaps? We did find there were a few, and that really fueled us in terms of the approach with the compost as well as the organic fertilizer. Planted cover crops as well too, and we don't till our soil, so that helps build up that soil profile. We get all the red wigglers out of the compost pile, and that helps with the soil and aerates things as well and helps us with drainage. But it also saves the erosion by having those cover crops there. And of course, the bees love it here because we've got this pollinator mix out there, and there's a carpet of daisies right now. And we have these little mason beehives we get every season from a retired fellow here in the valley that kind of helps that population as well. He comes and sets them up, and the bees are all over them. So it's really nice to have that balance. And that's the one thing, if there's any sort of theme that's come out of this, one word that often describes things, it's around the right balance, both in the vineyard and in the winemaking.
So I would love to, you know, we haven't talked a lot about your actual wines, and I'll come back to that in a minute. I mean, thank you for explaining the varieties that you make and why. And I'm going to touch on some of your wines a bit later. But just picking up from all of this, the foundation that you inherited, the thoughtfulness, and now you carrying that on and taking it forward. You've had about 7 years now under your belts at Alderley. You've had some time to settle in to learn a lot. I imagine it sounds like you have, and thinking very thoughtfully about where you are and what you'd like to do with your land and your product. So one of the aspects about looking forward for any winery, getting into some other nuts and bolts aside from the farming, is production levels. And you mentioned just now when you came into Alderley, they were producing about 2,000 cases a year, I think. So it's a big discussion, I think, in the wine industry about how to grow, if to grow, how quickly, What are your views on your planning for, let's say, the next 5 years and beyond in terms of your setting your production levels? You know, for a lot of producers, it's a tricky balance between, on the one hand, hitting the production levels you need to achieve the bottom line margins that you're striving for to keep your business going, you know, with, and to what happens if you have a low yielding year, or you just want, you want to stay small. I know it'll be a different context for different businesses, depending on their maturity, where they're located, what kind of wine they're making. But for you, you know, what's your view for maybe your winery or winery your size? You know, what's your approach on this right now?
Yeah, great question. I think coming back to that idea of the balance piece is really key. We knew when we came into this in 2017 that the 2,000 cases was kind of the minimum to be able to sort of pay your bills and, you know, keep your head above the water, service your debt and all of that. So we knew coming in we would need to grow to some degree. And we were fortunate that we didn't end up having to buy more land and plant more vines in order to do that. There was actually another vineyard planted about 5-6 years ago, just down 600 meters away from us on Stamps Road. So essentially same terroir, very aligned in farming practices, our good friends at Saison there. And so then they're growing similar varietals to the ones that we're making now. So what we've been able to do with that partnership is to grow now to about 3,500 cases max. And that's where things, you know, you get a little bit more comfortable. It's a size where, you know, the numbers make a bit more sense, and yet we can still do it within our same infrastructure, you know, a bit more capital investment in some equipment, but within the same footprint, because any bigger than that, and you start to have a challenge where now all of a sudden we need a full-time staff member versus our seasonal help or more. You know, now if we're any bigger, we've got to start to worry more about sales and, you know, carrying an inventory and possibly building another, you know, building another building in order to be able to produce that volume. So you kind of get to about this size. It's a kind of that sweet spot, because there definitely is a tipping point where, you know, beyond that, you really need to start to invest in more people, more infrastructure and so forth. And at about, you know, 3,200 cases or so, I don't wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning anymore in a panic about how am I going to be able to supply people with wine, because there'll be enough for everybody, both my wine club members, people that want to visit us, the restaurants and liquor stores that carry our product as well. So prior to that, I was often, inventory management was a real challenge for mm-hmm. good reason, but still a challenge. So it's great to have access to real quality grapes. And again, that sort of helps us in those years with some of the fluctuations where there's opportunities to get more fruit. Can we make more wine? And if it's a bit of a slower year, well, we've made, you know, enough inventory to sort of carry us and see us through.
It's a dance and it's a balance. And thank you for mentioning the aspects around allocation and distribution. And choosing, it's great to be loved and everyone wants a piece of you. And then also, you know, how do you balance keeping and wanting to give your wine clubs some of your beautiful art in the glass, but also, you know, distribution is also marketing and getting exposure. And I think it's really tricky. And so I commend you for that balance, but also for being able to get a bit more sleep at night and not to worry about it. But, you know, people talk about, again, not only in the winery space, but I suppose any business, that point at which you can get too big, because you get too big, you can't manage the growth, you overextend yourself on the growth, and then you know, you can't keep up with your plans. And I think that's with many businesses, people have got to think through that. So thank you for sharing that of your story. Gosh, there's so many things we could chat about. I know that you were just in the Okanagan Valley recently, visiting there, and we could probably spend a couple of hours on this. But maybe we won't, which is the Okanagan Valley has its own challenges recently on the farming side, but it affects the whole industry there, namely the acute cold weather earlier this year and also late 2022, and also the effects of forest fires, the devastation from forest fires on the land and people's habitat, and also tourism. Right now, your neck of the woods doesn't have those exact specific acute challenges. You know, I know that fire smoke comes over to the islands. you have different kinds of challenges on the climate and weather side of things, I think. Can you just share, for people who don't know, you know, what are the sorts of things that, I guess, in addition to some of the business imperatives you're chatting about, what keeps the farmers on Vancouver Island awake at night? You know, what are you worried about in a growing season?
Yeah, well, certainly before talking about Vancouver Island, I would just also briefly like to acknowledge that just the devastation that they've experienced in the Okanagan with this, and how, to your point, it's devastating for the BC wine industry as a whole. So it's not a good thing for BC wine, period. We're somewhat sheltered from that, but definitely we really feel for our peers out there. And mm-hmm. and certainly we, you know, we're very, very sympathetic to their plight. Obviously, the climate here is quite different, you know, more moderate growing climate for sure. You know, beyond the challenges, you know, that I alluded to earlier with the Merlot and ripening, because again, sometimes, you know, we don't always get the heat that we'd like. So some mm-hmm. of the varietals that we're growing here can be a little more challenging than others. Although for the most part, I think we have a lot of that dialed in here now after the many years that the wineries have been on the island. We have our own disease pressures for sure. Whether that's the more moderate climate things that we fall prey to, like mildew, botrytis, and some of those things, obviously trunk disease, particularly when you start to get into the older, you know, vineyards like ours, trying to keep an eye on that. Obviously, we know that we do have phylloxera here as well, and that's always a threat. Although in many cases, much of our plantings are on sort of disease-resistant rootstock, which does help. But climate change, you know, we're not sort of sheltered from the volatility of that either. And it can definitely provide some extreme challenges, particularly to new plantings. Then there's been a lot of planting here over the last few years. And some of those drought conditions where, you know, the younger plantings require more water. So that the devastating heat dome we saw in 2021, there were a few vineyards here that, you know, really, really struggled with that, with their younger plantings. And obviously, just looking on the horizon and being on guard for what new pests might be introduced as the climate changes, you're thinking of things like, you know, insects and things that we sort of haven't necessarily experienced here. And we say, oh, we don't have to worry about that because it's not here. Well, some of those things are slowly moving here. So, you know, we really do need to be mindful of that and, you know, be constantly doing our research. And this is where our Wine Island Growers Association that we're a part of and many of the island wineries are, you know, is on the forefront of that and can provide some guidance to us.
I was just going to mention that I was thinking about what I perceive as real collegiality when I visit the Wine Islands region, be it on the Southern Gulf Islands or on Vancouver Island. And sharing, and you mentioned Saison Vineyard, which, you know, wonderful fruit comes from, but information and education and really banding together. And you mentioned the Wineries Association. I think you're one of the fearless leaders there at the mm-hmm. moment or now, Cowichan Wineries Association, I think it's called. So can you just provide a bit of a summary about that association and who the constituents are and, you know, what your mission is right now or what, as a collective, you think, where that group would like to take this region? Or is it not necessarily about taking it somewhere, it's being together and sharing the information. How much of it is, do you think, sharing the viticulture and banding together so that you can collectively have these sustainable businesses and vision of stewards of the land? Or is it also in addition to, is it kind of a branding or a marketing group where you can help get the word out to consumers in a consensus or a concise fashion?
Sure. So, so the Wine Island Growers Association that I alluded to earlier, that's really the body kind of focused primarily around the viticulture and the winemaking side of things. And they've been going for a very long time. And Zach, my husband's involved in that. And then recently I took a more of a leadership role in our Cowichan Winery Society. And so that's essentially born out of the exercise we went through a few years ago now, where we basically obtained a what's called as a sub-GI or a grid geographic indicator. So Cowichan Valley, like Napa, like Naramata, we're officially a wine region. And right now that comprises 13 wineries here in the Cowichan Valley. And so the primary purpose behind the society is essentially to obviously promote and promote the region, educate people about, you know, how unique our wine region is, how it differs from other wine regions. You know, we're a little bit atypical and something maybe a little different from what people might be used to seeing. We have recently, you know, gone through a bit of a branding exercise to kind of solidify our visual identity and sort of key messaging and sort of help people understand, hey, we're here, this is what we're all about, and this is how we're different from other wine regions that you may have experienced elsewhere. We kind of are a little bit on the edge, and just, you know, for our you know, location and just the natural beauty, and maybe, as I say, just not your typical wine region.
On that, I wanted to ask you about one of the ones that you have made, and I imagine is close to your heart. Alderley has won a number of awards for your wines. You mentioned your Bacchus. I absolutely love your Bacchus. I also love the Valerie, the white blend that you make. I understand that Zach started as your primary winemaker at Alderley when you started in 2017, but you also have become a winemaker. So, and the Valerie is your baby. So can you share a little bit about what's in that bottle and the story behind it?
Sure. Yeah, Zach, as you say, is sort of the inspiration behind me sort of getting more involved in the winemaking side. He's an excellent coach, and so we both thought it might be nice to do a project where we could pay tribute to my late mom, Valerie. Mm-hmm. And so that wine is really sort of inspired by her. It also helped kind of solve a problem for us, because when we were at our previous volume of 2,000 cases of wine a year, we were often sold out of white wines by about July, which was a problem in our tasting room. And we thought, well, maybe we've got this Viognier that we're growing here that, you know, could create an opportunity if we wanted to create a new wine. And what could we blend that with? And this is where we had the opportunity to partner with another winery just in the Cobble Hill area. And acquire some Ortega, and we kind of came up with this 80-20 blend of Ortega Viognier, and the two varietals just together are like kind of like poetry. Ortega is that lovely sort of light floral, just a hint of floral, but really delicate, and then of course the Viognier, which can sometimes be, you know, has a lot of personality and can be sometimes a bit in your face depending on where it's grown. But the two of them together, they really come together beautifully. And again, they're made in a similar style to our other white wines. So very aromatic, very fruit forward. And it was supposed to be a 1-year project that was going to help us, you know, through a summer in the tasting room. And now we're on our sixth vintage because it has its own little following and has continued to grow in popularity. We only do about 100 cases a year, and it's just a tasting room wine. But many of our wine club members are hooked on Valerie, and I know my mother would have been delighted with it.
It is an absolutely beautiful wine. I am never disappointed by that drop, and it is a heady, aromatic blend. And when I say heady, I don't mean overwhelming. I mean just in the most beautiful, transportive way. I really, really love it. I hope you can still keep making it. And, you know, I love how you shared the genesis of the blend, because I often hear when I visit wineries, winemakers or owners telling me about sometimes accidents or surprises that are at the start of some beautiful wines, things that they didn't plan. It wasn't in their plan. It could have been that grapes were hanging on a vine longer than they think. Then all of a sudden they've got this beautiful dessert wine that they've never planned on making, or they were short on something and they had to fill their vats and they found and they MacGyvered it. And so thank you, because it just shows, you know, the surprise that can come from the unplanned and the wonderful art that can come from that. So thank you so much. Now, you mentioned that this wine is just for your tasting room, and I have been to your tasting room and I love it. I love that it's intimate and small and really comfortable, and being able to come and see your spot is gorgeous in the vines. Can you share with us and let us know what this season right now? Has your season started? Can people come to your tasting room? How do they come to see you if people don't know Alderley? How do they connect with you?
Sure, yeah. So we're our tasting room generally is open daily by appointment. The only time it wouldn't be open is if we're literally just not going to be here, because when you come to Alderley, you meet me or Zach or both of us. You'll always generally meet Vino as well. She's actually the headliner, Vino, our vineyard dog, who's been with us since a month after we took over here. If you Google us, literally the top three terms that come up are like Vino, dog, and then wine. Yeah. So people come for the dog and stay for the wine. So open daily by appointment. We went to an appointment model, through COVID, and what we really found was it was the best opportunity for us to provide a great customer service experience and really connect with people who visit us. So as I say, you can call us, email us, text us. And as I say, we will look after you.
So I guess looking forward, if we're going to look into our glass ball about the future and anything coming from the pandemic and silver linings or what's happening with climate, and also increased visibility of your region and, just in from altitude, for people who don't know, Jackson Family Wine members from California have recently, in the last couple of years, invested in Unsworth and Blue Grouse, which are other larger wineries in the Cowichan Valley. But there's lots of focus from consumers and locals in BC who are starting to look towards the coast to visit, becoming more aware of the offering. So, from altitude, where do you think your region and our Salish Sea area, if it's Cowichan as a GI or the broader area, where do you think it might be in 10 years, or where would you like it to be in terms of what consumers are drinking or how they're talking about it or how the wineries are articulating your place? Or is it too soon to tell?
I think things are really starting to take shape, and you kind of alluded to it there, talking about, the introduction of some new players here, which I think, there's an opportunity there. They certainly bring some expertise and some experience, and also they help, increase some exposure to our region. So I do think that creates a lot of interest. The fact that, we've got this wine society now is working and is out there to sort of promote and educate people and really sort of a champion of our values and helps distinguish us as being unique, whether it's, through the quality of our wines, through our authenticity and our openness in the Cowichan Valley, that the passion that people, see when they come to visit us and the enthusiasm and how we're so connected to our communities and we're so much about local, but also just the, the diversity of the experience that people will have visiting us here. I kind of coined this term as I was reflecting on this conversation today about cohesive diversity. I don't know if that's a thing, but you get so many different experiences here across the Cowichan Valley visiting the wineries that I think it's a real attribute. And it's something that I think, people will enjoy when they visit us, but it'll also give them a reason to come back. So I think there's definitely some positives there in terms of as we grow, as the quality of the wines improves, as the vines get older, and hopefully as, we start to see more investment in infrastructure around tourism to be able to support more visitors to the region and things like that. I think that inevitably the link that we have to the food and to culture, there's a lot of people out there that are concerned about, Gen Z or millennials or alcohol consumption going down and panic about that. And I think that in many ways, that also forces our industry to be sharper, to be more streamlined and kind of to raise our game. But ultimately, wine isn't going to go away. And, we're so linked to culture and food. There's always going to be a market and an opportunity. And I do think that the future is bright. I think that a lot of the things we're doing now around in this region, around the sustainability side of things, around the different wines that we're producing, there's enough there to draw people in and to keep them coming back and to have them tell their friends.
I completely agree with everything you've just said from my point of view and my experience, and cohesive diversity. Thank you. I that really resonates with me. And I think about that a lot. Also, having lived in Australia for many years, you mentioned Zach, part of his adventure was in Australia, and I lived in 15 years. I had the great opportunity to travel through much of Australia exploring wine. And also when I lived in Sydney, because they don't have the same intra-state trade barriers that we have in Canada. Mm-hmm. So you can drink wine from all over the country. And, you know, people think of Australia as, oh, it's all hot and there'll be this one kind of Chardonnay and this one kind of Shiraz. That is not the case. We don't see the diversity where we're sitting here, but it's an amazing diversity. And there's a Team Australia approach. They have very distinct regions, but there is diversity of approach and there is a cohesiveness there. And I've always thought in my mind, wow, that is a paradigm that I think is consistent with what we can do in British Columbia. So I completely hear what you're saying. And I agree with you. I think wine is not just about the wine, and it will keep taking many of us back, even for those who don't taste wine. I'm sure you've had lots of people coming in your tasting room who might be with people are on their own who don't actually drink wine, but they want to know the story, and it's about being present in the place. And I'd like to thank you for being part of this, to you and Zach, for being part of what I think is a very exciting part of the world. I'm partial because it's from where I'm from. Beautiful, but thank you for creating this lovely, lovely place that we, the people, can just go and be present and enjoy what the land brings us. So I look forward to coming back soon to clink glasses and try some Valerie. And on the Merlot, yes, I've had that Merlot. Who would have thought Merlot from Vancouver Island? But Zach makes a great one when you have those berries. So thank you so much for joining today. I know you have a very busy week, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Sounds great. Thanks, Tanya. I'd love to see you anytime.
Thank you for joining my flight today to Alderley Vineyards in Cowichan Valley on beautiful Vancouver Island. If you're heading that way this season, please feel free to drop me a line. I'd be happy to give you some travel recommendations as to where to eat, sip, and play. If you have any friends, contacts, or colleagues you think might be interested in learning more about our Wine Islands region here in beautiful British Columbia, please do share my episode podcast. I'm all grassroots right now. I look forward to seeing you back here on the TT Wine Explorer podcast for our next flight. I'm not sure where we're going yet, but I look forward to seeing you on the ride. Take care.